Sunlight fell through the overhanging branches, and the shadows on the ground formed lacy patterns. Before she knew it, she was at the alchemy tree, which was pulsating with green blood within its bark, so alive it might as well have been human. She stood with her arms out and ran her hands over the tree. Everything glowed and shimmered, undulating before her eyes. She could actually taste the air. It was vanilla and moss. There were black weeds beneath her feet, and when she wished them to bloom, they did so, in shades of lilac and persimmon. She lay down in the brambles, sinking into them, yet she didn't feel the stickers. They drew blood, but the thorns didn't hurt, and each bruise of blood resembled a rose. If she were dead, would she be reunited with Levi? Was he waiting for her right now? There were yellow warblers flickering by as they migrated, as if specks of light had broken off from the sun. The brightness of the little birds in the fading shadows was blinding. Jack closed her eyes. Still, she couldn't escape the light. Inside her eyelids, there were fireflies. How had they gotten there? Everything was too bright. Dazzling. She thought she saw Levi, and she ran after him, but when she blinked, he was gone. Now she was in the dense woods. Her breath was composed of filmy black sparks that rose up whenever she exhaled. She definitely heard his voice. She tracked the stream called the Gill and traipsed through the mud, not stopping until she came to the lake. The black water had turned into a mirror. Jet crouched on hands and knees and looked at herself. What she saw loomed. The girl who had ruined everything she touched. She crawled closer to get a better look, and as she did, she tumbled into the lake. In no time, she was in up to her waist. She deserved this. This was what was done to witches. Though she was freezing, she plunged farther into this watery-looking glass. She wanted to sink down, to be punished and done away with, but she felt the buoyancy inside her, and she floated when she meant to drown. It was no good. She would not sink. She swam to the edge and sloshed through the mud. The grass was still pulsing with life. Jet struggled to breathe. It had been 6 hours since she had taken the tab of acid. It was no longer daytime. Stars filled the sky. There were still a few fireflies behind her eyelids. She walked all the way home, following Fifth Avenue to the very end. When she came inside, Franny saw that her clothes were wet and that her dark hair was damp around her face. "What did you do?" Franny asked. There was a circle of sorrow around her sister, a pale gray-blue, as though she were still walking through water. "Nothing," Jet said. "I wasn't paying attention." "You tried to drown yourself." Franny could see it. The edge of the lake, the water weeds, the moment when her sister gave in to the call to go deeper. "It was an accident." Franny went to embrace her sister. "The world will do enough to us. We don't have to do it to ourselves," she said. "Stay away from water. Promise me." Jet promised. She crossed her heart. But in fact, she now knew that if a witch wanted to drown herself, she could do so. All she needed was some assistance. A stone, a rock, a spell, a cup of poison, a steely heart. A world of sorrow. Then, and only then, could it be done. Once a week, Jet walked uptown to the Plaza Hotel at 5th and 59th Street. No one knew where she was. To the crowds rushing by, she was nothing, just a young woman in black standing on the sidewalk, crying. She always went directly to the place where it happened, and when she did, she could feel the last moments she had spent with Levi before his accident. Even though she'd lost the sight, those instants were so powerful they hung in the air and were threaded through the trees. Everything glowed with a peculiar bright light. He'd held her near. He'd told her to close her eyes. She'd said, "Don't be silly," but he had insisted. At last he'd placed something in her hands. "Now look," he'd said. "What is this?" She'd laughed, feeling the small circular surprise in her hands. "A bottle cap?" But when she opened her eyes, she saw he had given her a ring. A thin silver band with a moonstone. She hadn't taken it off since, though the silver had tarnished. In the park in front of the hotel, she watched the trees for a sign, but there was none. No dove, no raven, no spark of light. Then one day, as she was working in the shop, she stumbled upon what she needed. The potion. That week, she walked into the Plaza Hotel and rented the room Levi had reserved. He had showed her the reservation, so she knew the room number. 708. Sometimes that number came up in the oddest places. On the cash register in the shop when someone bought a bar of black soap. In the grocery store when she went to pay for bread and milk. If it was over the door of a restaurant, she then must stop, whether or not she was hungry. Jet told the bellman she didn't need help, then she tipped him $5 and went up alone. There was no one in the elevator or in the hall. It was very quiet. She was glad she couldn't hear the thoughts of those inside the rooms she was passing. She appreciated silence now. Even the door to her room made no noise when she slipped inside. She drew the curtains and flung open the windows. Then she peered into the bathroom to see the huge tub and all the lovely bath salts and soaps. And finally she lay down on the bed, fully clothed. She could spy the tops of the trees in the small park in front of the hotel and a wedge of blue sky. She thought about what might have been if the accident hadn't happened. How they would have walked into the hotel together, come up to their room, this very room. They would have sat on the bed, shyly at first, before daring to embrace. He would have been gentle and kind, although mad for her, and they might have cried together afterward, overwhelmed by sex and emotion. She supposed she was weeping as she thought about this, and the sound carried, and there was a knock on the door. She didn't answer. Perhaps guests nearby had complained. She forced herself to be quiet. But as it turned out, she had left the door unlocked, and someone came into the room. "Are you all right, miss?" It was the bellman. Jet didn't answer, so the bellman pulled up a chair and sat down. He was young and had a worried expression. "When people check in without luggage, you never know what they're going to do," he said. "And then I heard you crying. I put two and two together." "I'm fine," Jet managed to say. "Please go." "You're not going to kill yourself or anything like that?" Jet shook her head. It was safer not to speak. "Because I would feel responsible. I would be the last person to have seen you. That would mean that I forever would carry this moment around and think of what I could have done to stop you. My life would probably be ruined. I'd get off track and start to drink, and I'd drop out of school, and after a while this place would fire me because everyone would blame me. And worst of all, I'd blame myself." Jet began sobbing anew. She turned away from him. There had been a plan, and he was ruining it. She felt the bed sink as he lay down beside her. "Don't cry," he said. He stroked her hair. "I can get you room service." In spite of herself, Jet laughed. "Room service? Why would that help?" "The room service is great," he protested. "You shouldn't pass it up." Jet turned to face him. They lay side by side looking into each other's eyes. His were very dark, flecked with gold. He told her his name was Raphael, and he was taking night classes at Hunter College. She told him she had lost the man she loved, and that she no longer believed in love, and wanted nothing to do with it. He told her he planned never to marry and thought love was probably a foolish endeavor. He had seen what had happened to his mother, who had raised three children without any help, and who worked two jobs, all due to love, while his father went on and married twice more and had other families and never looked back. Jet had found her perfect, bitter companion. She felt at ease in his presence. "What do they have here for room service?" Jet asked. Everything. You name it, they've got it. She wanted roast chicken, string beans, and a hot fudge sundae. Give me 15 minutes, Raphael said. Maybe 20. She fell asleep while he was gone, and she dreamed of the angel of the waters at the Bethesda fountain. The angel arose and was free from the shackles of metal and stone. She put out her hand and stopped time, and everything in Manhattan was motionless, except for the swirling stars above the city. It was then Jet knew what she wanted. To go back to that day and relive it. When Jet woke, Raphael had returned with a tray that he'd arranged for them. He brought enough for two. They ate together, except for the sundae, which Jet alone devoured. He'd been right. The room service was fabulous. "Are you going to get fired?" she asked. "No, my uncle is the head bellman." "I don't want your life to be ruined. I would feel bad if you did get in trouble." "Trouble's actually my middle name," he told her. "Raphael Trouble Correa." They both laughed. Then Jet looked serious. She got up her nerve.
"What if I wanted you to be him?" she asked.
"The dead man?"
"And we would never see each other again, and it would have nothing to do with love. You would just be him once."
Raphael thought this over. He had had many strange requests working in the hotel. People wanted privacy, or they wanted women, or they wanted drugs or drink. He always said he couldn't help them, because that was what his uncle, who'd hired him in the first place so he could put himself through school, had said to do. This, however, was different. "I think I'd have to be myself. I can't be a dead man." They had begun to drink the whiskey in the minibar. There were several varieties, all excellent. They'd had quite a few.
"You'll be him to me," Jet said. "That's what's important. I don't want to mislead you."
Raphael nodded. "I understand. Can you at least tell me his name?"
"Levi."
"From the Bible." That seemed to make him feel better about the situation. Was he a good man?
"He planned to go to Yale," Jet said. "Divinity school."
Raphael got up and went to lock the door. When he came back, he said he could wait in the hall vestibule while she undressed and got into bed. He felt as though he had wandered into a dream, and sometimes in a dream you just follow the path you're given without asking too many questions. For once you do, the dream is over.
"That's not the way it would happen," Jet told him.
So he sat on the bed beside her and kissed her, and they kissed for a very long time. This was the way it would have begun. At first she thought she would cry again, but then Jet kept her eyes closed and the bellman was Levi to her. She said Levi's name. Raphael might have been offended, but inside he pitied the dead man for all he had missed out on. He unbuttoned Jet's blouse and undressed her gently, just as Levi would have. He had a condom in his wallet, though he hadn't expected to use it today. Jet kept her eyes closed. When Raphael touched her, he expected her to be cold, but she wasn't. She was hot under his touch. "I want you to look at me," he told her. When she did, he said, "I don't want to be the dead man." Jet turned away and began to cry, but he insisted. "We can't pretend. We're both alive. We have to do this like living people. Otherwise, I wouldn't feel right." She really looked at him. He was a handsome young man who was worried about her, even though he didn't know her. She kept her eyes open as he made love to her. She was supposed to have had her first time with Levi, but instead she was here in bed with a stranger. They could hear traffic on Fifth Avenue. They could hear the wind in the trees. When she embraced him, he was himself, and that was fine. "Is this one of these things where I have to be responsible for you for my whole life now?" Raphael asked. "Like when you save someone from death and then you're their angel, and you can't have any peace until you know they're all right?"
"I am all right," Jet said.
"Then why am I still worried?" It was dusk now, and the room was dark. Jet was pretty certain Raphael would get fired, despite his uncle.
If you lose your job, it would be the reverse. Then I have to be responsible for you.
If I lose my job, it's fate, he said.
We make our own fate, Jet said. And then all at once she realized that they did. They could not control it, but they could choose how to respond to what happened. She insisted he get dressed and go back to work. He did so, although he seemed reluctant to go.
So this isn't a relationship, Raphael said.
Absolutely not. She told him about the curse and the trouble people in her family had in matters of love. There was no reason not to tell him everything, since they would remain as strangers. The truth was, he looked different to her now. He was even more good-looking than she thought at first, and he had a concerned expression. He wasn't Levi, and he wasn't going to be, no matter how hard she tried to pretend that he was. We should meet here in 6 months.
Check in with each other, he said.
Then I would know you didn't kill yourself.
Jet shook her head.
I won't. But we're never going to see each other again. Let's just get that straight.
You miss him, Raphael said. Even right now.
She did, but the day of the accident now felt as though it belonged to the past. She was glad she had kept her eyes open. I'm glad you were you, Jet said.
He kissed her goodbye as himself, and then they both laughed.
So am I, he told her. When Raphael left, Jet took a long bath. Then she put on a white robe and finished what was left of the chicken. She got into bed and phoned Franny to tell her where she was.
You are not at the Plaza Hotel, Franny said. That costs a fortune.
I had to stay here. I needed to complete what should have happened that night. She could see the lights come on along Fifth Avenue now. Raphael would be checking out of work and heading for night class. He had told her he wanted to be a teacher. She went to the window and gazed out. She thought she saw him, but she wasn't sure. She barely knew him, after all.
It's beautiful here, she told her sister.
She'd forgotten how lovely this guy was at this hour of the day.
Will you come home in the morning? Franny wanted to know. We can't afford another night at the Plaza.
Yes, Jet assured her. I promise I will.
After I have breakfast from room service. The Plaza Hotel was the least of their financial problems. There were heating bills and electricity and taxes, things their parents had seen to in the past. Even before the shop opened, their savings had all but disappeared. Jet set a paper spell, hoping to bring money their way, burning a dollar bill coated with honey and milk in the fireplace. The only result was an order from a small pharmacy on Bleecker Street for a box of black soap. Franny had altered the recipe, adding city ingredients that were available. There were no blooming roses outside the door, no lush herbs and flowers as there were in Isabel's garden, so she made good with what she had. A branch from an ash tree in Washington Square Park. Two dappled feathers of a nesting dove on West 4th Street. Leaves from the wavering lilacs in their yard. The result was grittier than Aunt Isabel's recipe, with more intensity. Wash with it, and not only were you beautiful, you were ready to do battle. It was especially good for anyone riding the subway or walking down a dark street after midnight. The pharmacy ordered several more boxes in the ensuing months, but the sale wasn't enough to sustain them. When their money ran out, they had no choice but to divest themselves of family belongings. They sold their mother's good Limoges china at a bad price. They sold the French cooking pots and then the costume jewelry their mother favored, jeweled bugs and starfish and butterflies. One gray day, when they hadn't enough to pay the electricity bill, they brought nearly all of Susanna Owens's Chanel suits and Dior dresses to the second-hand store on 23rd Street near the Chelsea Hotel. Franny bargained as best she could, but in the end they collected only a few $100s for the timeless clothes their mother had bought in Paris when she was young and in love. They sat in the lobby of the Chelsea Hotel and counted their money.
You could have stayed here instead of the Plaza, Franny said. Then maybe we wouldn't be so broke.
My fate wasn't here.
Jet had a small smile on her face that gave her away.
Oh, really?
Franny now understood.
What was your fate's name?
It doesn't matter, Jet assured her. Franny narrowed her eyes.
Love?
Absolutely not. We never intend to see each other again, Jet said cheerfully.
Perfect, Franny said. Then you're the new Maid of Thorns.
Oh, no, Jet said. You'll always hold that title.
Will I?
Franny said thoughtfully. Jet went to her sister and sat beside her.
Franny, that was a joke.
You have the softest heart of any of us.
Untrue,
Franny shot back, though she was near tears. She had hated seeing her mother's clothes hung on wire hangers in the thrift shop.
Very true.
This just means I know you better than you know yourself, Jet said.
But what else is a sister for?
Posters were affixed to every lamppost in the neighborhood, and Franny took a small ad in the Village Voice, the alternative newspaper whose offices were right around the corner in Sheridan Square. On the day of the grand opening, the shelves were stocked with cures, and Edgar the Heron was set in the window and festooned with ribbons and bows. By noon, only a smattering of people had showed up, a huge disappointment. Two teenage girls with long, straight hair in search of true love sneaked in, giggling, afraid of the stuffed heron, nervous about magic, eyeing the bones and teeth set out in jars. Franny threw up her hands, preferring the drudgery of cleaning the storeroom, but Jet found she enjoyed dispensing cures and was happy to offer the girls the most basic potion. Rosemary leaves, anise seeds, honey, and red wine. Since the Plaza Hotel, she had retained a deep empathy for those in love. She told the girls about a home remedy they could use when their money ran out. Not wise for a shopkeeper to give away free advice, but true to Jet's nature. To grow a lover, she told them, they must plant an onion in a flower pot and add plenty of sunlight and water. The girls were amused to hear that such a plain, smelly thing as an onion could bring love to them.
That's all we have to do?
They cried, delighted. Jet told them yes. An onion and a pure heart were the best ingredients. She'd had a pure love, too, once upon a time. These girls were too young and innocent for doves' hearts or spells written in blood. They hadn't the faintest idea of what love could do. Jet, on the other hand, knew only too well, and should she ever forget, should she wake up in the middle of the night and not know where or who she was, there was always the scar on her face to remind her. You had to squint to see its delicate outline, but it was there. Jet could run her hand over her face and feel it, and then she thought about the glass breaking and the sound of the thud as the taxi had hit Levi. That was when she would phone Raphael, who at this point knew her better than anyone. It wasn't love, not at all, but he'd been right. He'd saved her from what she had intended to do at the Plaza Hotel that night, and now he felt responsible for her. In some way, she was his. He'd known what she'd planned to do. She'd brought along a tincture of belladonna that night, a mixture that quickly induces dizziness and nausea, then weakness and breathing complications. She had planned to ingest it, then get into the bath. And when she passed out, she would drown, which seemed only fitting. No one could float after partaking of this tincture, not even her. Raphael had derailed her plans when he came into the room and lay down beside her. He'd reminded her that she was alive. The last time they'd met, she'd showed him the alchemy tree. They'd brought along a six-pack of beer, and after the second bottle, Raphael admitted that he had guessed her plan when she'd said she didn't need help getting to her room, yet tipped him $5 anyway. In return, he had saved her life. He was her secret, one she kept close. It wasn't love, but for her, it was something more. He was someone she trusted. Vincent had stopped bringing random women home, which was a relief to both sisters. They'd never known whom they might find in the kitchen when they went to fix their morning coffees. A teenager from Long Island in her t-shirt and nothing else. A waitress from the Kettle of Fish. A college girl from NYU, all wandering through the house with spellbound, confused expressions.
"Why do you bother?"
Franny had asked once. She was at the table eating toast. Some woman had just made herself scrambled eggs before leaving, without even bothering to introduce herself. "What is that supposed to mean?" Vincent snarled, defensive, brooding over why he could never feel anything for the girls he brought home.
"Fine, never mind."
"Why do you bother?" Vincent tossed back at his sister.
"I don't."
They were not the sort to discuss their emotions, or even admit they had them, so Franny kept her insights to herself. "I think we have a disorder. Maybe we should have read Dad's book," Vincent wondered. "We might have been more normal." Actually, Franny had been reading it. She'd expected to find it preposterous, filled with crackpot theories about genetics. But as it turned out, a stranger in the house was a love letter to Dr. Burke Owens's children, something none of them would have ever guessed. Certainly Franny was shocked by her father's warm, loving attitude. "They may be nothing like you," he had written. "They may surprise you. They may even repel you when their behavior is out of control, when they climb out their windows and drink underage and break every rule. But you will love them in a way you had not thought possible before, no matter who they turn out to be." All that year, Vincent had earned cash by busking on corners and in subway stations. His exceptional voice made people cluster around, especially when he sang of the troubled times. He felt connected when he performed. He found that if he put away his guitar, there was nothing inside him. It was as if when he had been stolen as an infant, he had come back as a changeling, as if someone had reached inside him and grabbed his heart to keep under lock and key. He had always been a night owl, but now he had found a coterie of late-night rovers. He frequented the clubs on 8th Street, Café Agogo, the Bitter End, the Village Gate, and often dropped by the San Remo, the hangout of poets, both unknown and great, including Burroughs, Ginsberg, Corso, and Dylan Thomas. Vincent listened to the poets who had no hope of ever making it, and those who were on the cusp of changing the meaning of what poetry was and could be. Whenever possible, he caught Bob Dylan at Gertie's. Dylan was making his mark as a poet and musician with a voice that was unmistakably his own. That was true beauty. That was the map of one's soul. To do so meant to reveal some inner part of yourself, and that Vincent was unable to do. By now, he was known in the clubs. Some people knew him from the Jester, and when they called him the Wizard, the nickname stuck. When he spoke, his voice was so soft that whomever he was addressing had to lean in to hear, and then some sort of enchantment happened. He was more handsome than ever, but that was only part of the spell he cast. Rumors began. People said he could pick your pocket without ever touching you. He could swipe a song lyric right out of your head. He seemed to know what you were thinking, or maybe you'd blabbed a chorus to him, and when he added a few words, he made it so much better than anything you could ever dream up that in the end you wouldn't even recognize your own music. He carried a book of spells with him, and for the right payment he could make things happen for you. The unexpected became real before your eyes. A girl who never looked at you before would follow you home. A job for which you weren't qualified would be yours. A letter would arrive informing you of an inheritance from a relative you hadn't known existed. Vincent worked briefly as a waiter at the Gaslight, where he gratefully ate for free from their quirky menu, date nut bread and cream cheese, grilled cheese, beef burger, pink lemonade, and a series of sundaes he sneaked home for Jet, mint, brandy, rum, chocolate, and vanilla. He'd have to run all the way home to Greenwich Avenue so the ice cream wouldn't melt and leave sugary puddles on the sidewalk. Eventually, the management fired him when a ticked-off waitress he had rejected ratted him out as being underage. On the weekends, he usually made a quick stop in Needick's, a hot dog place on 8th Street and 6th Avenue, before heading down to Washington Square Park, where folk musicians gathered on Sunday afternoons, He still had his same old Martin guitar he'd bought when he was 14, an instrument that seemed to feel and emote in a way that eluded him. He was inspired when he performed, his voice blessed with a soaring grace. And then he would stop and feel empty all over again. A hollow reed the wind blew through. Another young man in a black jacket hanging out on the corner of McDougal and Bleecker. "Are you sure you're 17?" the best guitar teacher in New York, Dave Van Ronk, asked after Vincent sat in to play with a group of older men at the park. Van Ronk was known as the mayor of McDougal Street, a pal of Dylan's and a legend himself. "I'm not really sure about anything," Vincent said, shaking the big man's hand, making sure not to run his mouth for once in his life. "Well, keep playing," Van Ronk said. "That's one thing you should be sure of." These were the times when children dreamed about nuclear testing and falling stars. There was an undercurrent of unrest, like a wave. Racial division in the cities. The war halfway around the world blooming with blood. When Vincent walked through Washington Square Park, he could hear the thoughts of the people he passed by. Such a ragged outcry of emotion he sometimes thought he would go mad. He understood why Jet seemed not to care that she had lost her gift. It was awful to hear the voices of dead paupers buried in unmarked graves beneath the cement paths. All but forgotten, they cried out to anyone who might hear them. For them, the world had been a vale of tears. The murdered, the abandoned, the ill, the ruined, victims and criminals alike all cried out to him. He wished he'd never had the sight. What had been a game when he was a boy had become an affliction. He had no desire to tap into other people's pain, to know them better than they knew themselves. He took to wearing a black cap woven out of metal thread in an attempt to shut out his clairvoyance. He'd found the cap on the Lower East Side where he'd bought his first book of magical instructions. He'd never admitted the truth to Franny, but he'd first read about the Magus in a book he'd found on a shelf in their father's office. For Dr. Burke Owens had studied folklore and ancient magic and Jungian archetypes. Vincent had been a kid, but one who knew what he wanted. He wanted to be the best at what he did, no matter the price. He searched for the Magus, but in every bookstore the clerks laughed at him and told him all of the copies had been burned long ago. Then he had come upon a shabby vendor strung out on drugs, who peddled magic from a makeshift room in an abandoned building. There, hidden in a wheelbarrow, beneath a threadbare blanket, Vincent found the book. In exchange for the text, Vincent had handed over a $50 bill filched from the coat pocket of one of his father's patients and a strand of his mother's pearls stolen from her jewelry box. He'd assumed the vendor had no idea of the true worth of this treasure, but then the old man had said to Vincent, "I've been wanting to get rid of that. It will lead you down the wrong path if you're not careful. It's a burden." When Vincent returned to search for the iron hat, he'd looked up the old vendor, but the magic man had long ago disappeared. Squatters had claimed the building he'd once occupied. They'd tried to turn Vincent away when he examined his predecessor's space, discovering the hat left on a shelf as if meant for him. Harassed, Vincent began a fire without flame or wood, and the squatters backed off. Standing in the ruin of a place, he'd felt oddly at home. He knew the creed he'd been taught by their aunt. The first rule of magic is do no harm, but that was not the world he was drawn to. Hexes, curses, conjuring for causing spiritual sickness, such practices could be addictive, especially when customers were willing to pay high prices for them. He set up shop in his predecessor's room. It was sympathetic magic he dealt in, some so exhausting he had to sleep for days to regain his strength. In no time, he had a list of wealthy clients who didn't care about the rule of three. They took it upon themselves to turn evil back on the one who had created it, which meant that a candle must be burned backward, or a container spell with mirrors must be put into use. Wicked magic was used to bind an enemy, often in business, wherein a photograph or doll or other image was used to represent the one who would be cursed. Some of the spells were painful and risky. all were unethical. And yet, Vincent began to collect and sell the paraphernalia of jealousy and hate. Coins, mirrors, combs, pyramids, figurines, amulets to protect, and those meant to harm. Franny had been right about his magical leanings. They led to trouble, and always had. His sisters loved him, but he couldn't be the person they wanted him to be. There was no reason for them to know how he earned his money. When he brought home bags of groceries and footed all the bills, they asked how he could afford to do so. He simply remarked, "What can I say? I'm a great waiter." He didn't bother to mention he'd been fired from the Gaslight. Did they truly believe the expenses were paid off in tips? Or from the profits of their shop, empty of customers most days? There was a fellow in Washington Square Park who dispensed certain illegal items needed for such spell work. Vials of blood, the hearts and livers of animals, who warned Vincent to be careful in the occult world. "What you send out will come back to you," this fellow had whispered in a thick voice. "Not once but threefold. What do you think happened to your predecessor? Are you ready for that, brother?" Vincent ignored the advice. He knew he was squandering his talents, but he didn't give a damn. There was always a price to be paid. What you get, you must also give. But he had cash now, and he didn't seem in the least bit jinxed. At least, not yet. In fact, he was gaining an audience in the village. He'd helped this along with invocations from the Magus, but so what? Fame was addictive, even the tiny bit he'd garnered. People crowded round him in the park, and often a group was gathered there waiting for him before he arrived. But he wondered if it was magic that drew them to him, and when they dispersed, he felt more alone than ever. He could make it happen if he wanted to. The crowds, the fame, the records, the stardom. But what would the price be? He thought of a story Franny had told him when he was a boy. A minstrel used sorcery to climb to the heights of fame. "Don't worry about the price," the wizard the musician had gone to had advised. And then the time came for reparations, when it was too late to change his mind. Only then did he discover that the price was his voice. On the night of his birthday, Vincent wandered home in the September dusk, a tall, stark figure, rattled by the magic in which he'd recently been complicit. Every time he had sold a spell for some perverse intention, to ensure that a rival would fail or a wife would disappear, he felt he'd sold a portion of his soul. It paid the bills, but he slept fitfully, and then not at all. In the middle of the night, he dressed and walked the streets in a daze, with a hollow feeling, as though he were famished and couldn't get enough to satisfy his hunger. He wanted to stop, but magic took hold and wouldn't let go. He was turning 18, but he felt so much older. Master of denial, master of dark magic, master of lies and loneliness. What good was it to be a conjurer if he couldn't conjure his own happiness? Now he was late for his own birthday dinner. Jet was making his favorite meal to celebrate, coq au vin with potatoes and fresh peas. Franny had baked Aunt Isabel's tipsy chocolate cake, the mere scent so intoxicating a person could get drunk on it. Still, he wasn't ready to face a celebration and pretend to be happy. He found an empty bench in Sheridan Square and gazed at the old streetlights, there for over 200 years. He made them dim, then go black. He could go in a bad direction, and he knew it. What would happen then? Would he lose his voice? Be unable to make amends? He smoked a joint and tilted his head up. There were no stars in the city sky. 18 years of being a liar, he thought. When he looked down, he saw that a creature was staring at him. "If you've come for me, you've made a mistake," he warned it. "I'll turn you into a rabbit." The animal came close enough for Vincent to feel its hot breath. It was no rabbit, but a black German shepherd, without a collar or leash. The dog faced him with a serious expression, his eyes flecked with golden light. Vincent smiled despite his glum frame of mind.
"Friend or foe?" he asked.
The dog offered his paw as an answer, and they shook.
"You're very well trained," Vincent said admiringly. "If you have no name, I'll call you Harry, after the greatest magician, Mr. Houdini. I would discuss your situation further, but it's my birthday, and I have to go home."
The dog trailed him across 6th Avenue, following to Greenwich Avenue. Vincent looked over his shoulder before coming to an abrupt halt.
"If that's what you have in mind, we might as well walk together. We're late for dinner."
Vincent had no friends, yet after he'd come home, Franny overheard him conversing with someone in the entrance hall. Curious, she went to peek. There was an enormous German shepherd who waited patiently as Vincent hung up his coat. Male witches were often known to have black dogs, or so the texts in the library had stated. Immediately, Franny knew this beast was Vincent's familiar, his double and alter ego, a creature of a different genus that had the same shared spirit. The dog shadowed Vincent into the kitchen, then lay beneath the table, waiting for his master's next move. Jet's little cat let out a howl when it spied the huge dog, then leapt from Jet's arms and raced from the room, skittering up the stairs to the safety of the second floor. The dog merely watched impassively. He clearly wasn't about to humiliate himself by giving chase.
"Poor Wren," Jet sighed. "Her home life has been ruined by a sibling."
"Like ours?" Franny teased.
"You know you were both thrilled when I was born. Or did you hire that nurse to get rid of me?
I could forgive you if you tell me there's a tipsy chocolate cake," Vincent said,
far more upbeat than usual, delighted to find he could be surprised by fate.
"If you tell us who your friend is," Franny countered.
As his birthday gift, she'd wished he wouldn't be so alone, and had burned a paper coated with honey to complete the spell. And now here he was with a companion.
"He's Harry." At the mention of his name, the dog picked up his huge head. "He'll be staying with us from now on."
When the sisters exchanged a look, Vincent added, "You have to admit, we won't have any robberies with him around."
"We wouldn't anyway," Franny said. "We've got a fixed spell on the door."
But she'd already filled a plate with chopped chicken and rice for the dog. She was pleased. Everyone knew a dog was an antidote to alienation.
"Happy birthday, dear Vincent."
It was a cheerful dinner, and when it was over, Vincent took out the trash without being asked, around to the alley where there were a dozen garbage cans. He was actually whistling. After all, he'd never liked his youth. Maybe he'd prefer being older. He inhaled the night air and listened to the city sounds he loved. Sirens in the distance, laughter and catcalls on the street. It was then he noticed a card atop the trash can. The ink was faded, nearly invisible to the naked eye, but he managed to read the message.
"Abracadabra."
It was Aramaic in origin, meaning, "I create what I speak, the most mystical and powerful blessing and curse. Begin by walking down Bleecker Street." Vincent glanced around. No one was in sight, only the dark, silky night. But he felt his pulse quicken. Clearly, he had somewhere to go. He went out after his sisters had gone to bed. He did this nearly every night, but this time was different. He was not headed for the jester and a night of drinking that would leave him blotto. He felt unusually elated as he headed down Greenwich to Bleecker. At the corner, he noticed the street sign was unfamiliar. It read Herring Street, the original street name of the address where Thomas Paine had lived, a name that hadn't been used for over 200 years. Something odd was happening. There had been a fusion between the present and the past. Things that were logical and those that were impossible were now threaded together. Well, if this was the way his 18th birthday was to be celebrated, so be it. He was a man tonight, legal in the eyes of New York State. There was a mist rising from the asphalt as he followed along Grove Street, where Thomas Paine had died in 1809. In honor of Paine's The Age of Reason, the surrounding lanes had virtue names. Art Street, now part of 8th Street. Science Street, which became Waverly Place. and Reason Street, renamed Barrow. Only Commerce Street, running between 7th Avenue and Barrow, was left with its initial name, a remnant of the past. Vincent realized he was headed onto an even tinier lane, one he'd never before noticed. Conjure Street. There he found a wooden brick townhouse with a knocker in the shape of a lion's head. Once he went inside, he realized it was a private club, yet no one stopped him from approaching the bar. He ordered a whiskey, not taking note of a man who came to sit beside him until he spoke. "I'm glad you could make it," the stranger said. "I'm a fan." "Of folk music?" "Of you." Vincent turned to him. The man beside him wore a gray suit and a shirt made of fine linen. For some reason, Vincent felt flustered. For once in his life, he fell silent. "I hope you don't have a rule about not talking to strangers," the man said. He let his hand fall upon Vincent's arm. Vincent felt stung, yet he didn't pull away. He just let the sting he felt go on, as if he wanted it, as if he couldn't understand how he'd ever lived without it. "I've heard you play in the park. I go most Sundays." Vincent's gaze settled on the man's dark, liquid eyes. When he tried to answer, there was a catch in his voice. He, who had talked himself in and out of trouble his entire life, who had charmed the nurse who had stolen him on the day he was born, and every woman since, without ever caring about a single one, had fallen silent, as if bewitched. "I'm thinking I should be an exception to the rule." "Talk to me," the man urged. "You'll be glad you did." Vincent's new companion introduced himself as William Grant, who taught history at the progressive university, the New School, although he seemed far too young to be a professor. "I've been waiting for you to notice me, but since you haven't, I thought I'd invite you here. The card was from me. You know as well as I do, Vincent, we don't have all the time in the world." William lifted his hand away to signal to the bartender for another round. In that instant, something happened to Vincent. He realized he had a heart. It came as a great surprise to him. He sat back on the bar stool, stunned. So this was it, and had been all along, the way a person felt when he was enraptured, when he didn't care about anyone else in the room, or in the city, for that matter. It had finally transpired, what he had seen in the mirror. The man he would fall in love with. They went to William's apartment on Charles Street. If there was anything Vincent might have done to stop it, he wouldn't have done so, for this occurred only once in a person's life, and then only if he was lucky. It happened the way things happen in a dream. A door opens, a person calls your name, your heart beats faster, and everything is familiar, yet you don't know where you are. You are falling. You're in a house you don't recognize, and yet you want to be here. You have actually wanted to be here all of your life. Vincent was shocked by the depth of his feelings. All of the women he'd had, and he'd felt nothing. Now he was burning. He was at someone's mercy, embarrassed by his own need. He, who prided himself on being a loner and not caring what anyone thought, cared desperately. When William ran his hands over Vincent's body, his blood was hot. He wanted to be here and nowhere else. In the past, the sex was only about what others might do for him. He had been selfish and thoughtless, but now he was a different man entirely. What they did together was a form of magic, maddening and ecstatic. Vincent didn't go home that night. He didn't care if he ate or slept, or if his sisters worried over what had become of him. William set up a Polaroid camera and took photographs of them together. They appeared as if by magic, lifting off the page. In each image, they embraced each other. It seemed they were one person, and that was when Vincent began to worry. If you were one, what befell you hurt the other as well. In a sudden cold sweat, he remembered the curse. He cared nothing about the ruination of himself. Trouble didn't have to look for him. He went right toward it. But William's fate was another matter. Not love, he and Franny always said to each other. For look at what had happened to Jet. Anything but that. And yet Vincent stayed, unable to give up this dream he'd stumbled into, the one he'd always had but had made himself forget. On their seventh day together, Vincent fell silent, exhausted by sex and by his own fears, which now had grabbed hold of him and wouldn't let go. What's wrong? William asked. Vincent couldn't bring himself to speak of the curse or let the idea of it into the room with them, even though William would have understood in a way another man would not. He was a bloodline whose relative Matthew Grant had been tried for witchcraft and then acquitted in Windsor, Connecticut, before disappearing. There was no official record of William's ancestor after his trial, but there didn't need to be. He'd come to New York, where the family had settled on Long Island, and William had spent every summer at his family's house on the shore. He had an easy manner, but was direct and comfortable with himself. He'd been to Harvard, so he understood Massachusetts as well, and he'd written his thesis on John Hawthorne, the witchfinder and judge who had sentenced so many of their kind to death, and several of the classes he taught at the new school centered on outsider societies. "Do you know your fate?" Vincent asked as they lay together, entwined. "I know yours," William laughed. "I told you when I met you." "To sing in Washington Square Park?" William grinned. "To be mine." When Vincent went missing, Franny was worried sick the first 2 days, furious over the next 2 days, and hurt every day that followed. "He'll be back," Jet insisted. "You know Vincent." Franny walked the dog, who continually pulled on his leash to the corner of Bleecker Street, then would stop, puzzled, refusing to walk on until Franny dragged him home. She wondered if her birthday wish had gone wrong and had driven Vincent further away. "You would know if something was wrong," Jet assured her sister. "You still have the sight." At last, Vincent phoned to say he was sorry to have been out of touch. Out of touch? Franny had barely slept a wink since her brother had disappeared. "I was afraid you were murdered." "Worse," Vincent told her. "I'm in love." "Very funny," Franny said. He'd had so many admirers, and he'd never cared about a single one. He laughed, understanding his sister's response. "This is different, kiddo."
"You don't sound like yourself."
Franny was already looking for a canister of salt and some fresh rosemary to dispel whatever afflicted him. "I am myself," Vincent told her. He gave her an address and told her to come see for herself. Franny packed up the ingredients she thought she might need, then leashed the dog and took off. Vincent's instructions were odd, however, and the streets unfamiliar. Finally, she came to Conjure Street. It was dusk when she thought she saw Vincent on the stoop of an old townhouse, but Harry didn't bark to greet him, and it was another man who waved to her. Franny approached, suspicious. The dog, on the other hand, went right to the stranger, who introduced himself as William Grant. Although he wasn't especially handsome, he had charisma, and even Franny was engaged by his manner.
"I'm meeting my brother here."
Franny was studying William more closely. His dark, sensitive eyes, his intensity. "I am as well."
"Really?"
There had been so many people who'd been mad for Vincent. Franny assumed she'd simply come across one more admirer. She had persisted with her childhood task of watching over her brother. Every week she dropped a protection amulet into his jacket pocket, made of black cloth and bound by red thread, containing clove and blackthorn. Often, however, she found the amulets discarded in the street. "And I'm here to meet you, too," the fellow said. "Your brother was too shy to be here when we first spoke."
"My brother? Shy? We're not talking about the same person."
William laughed. "This is all very new to him."
"But not to you?"
"Well, it is if you mean falling in love." When Franny didn't answer, it was William's turn to study her. "You can't be surprised. He thinks you knew before he did." She'd certainly known that Vincent had never been in love with a woman. That neighbor of their aunt's who had seduced him, the college girls, the waitresses, the fans of his music, all were meaningless. He rarely saw them more than once, and often couldn't remember their names. But William Grant was different. Franny knew it as soon as her brother came outside to join them. She could tell when he looked at William. "So now you know," Vincent said.
"I think I always knew," Franny said.
"Well, then now it's out in the open."
"I'm sure you don't mind if we speak privately,"
Franny said to William, taking her brother by the arm.
"Not at all."
They left William with the dog, who seemed perfectly content to be entrusted to this stranger.
"He has the sight," Vincent protested as Franny directed him toward an alley.
"There's no privately. It's all out in the open. You might as well speak in front of him." Her brother could be so irritating when he pretended to be dense.
"You know you're not supposed to do this," Franny said.
"Be with a man?"
"Fall in love."
They both laughed, then Franny's expression darkened.
"Seriously, Vincent, the curse."
"Oh, fuck it, Franny. Aren't you sick of being ruled by the actions of people who are long dead? Maybe everyone is cursed. Maybe it's the human condition. Maybe it's what we want."
Franny was truly worried. There was no one of whom she felt more protective.
She thought of sitting beside his crib with a canister of salt, refusing to leave him after he'd been returned to them. She had seen a halo around him, the sign of a beautiful but short life. Franny had the salt with her now, but here he was with a grin on his face. And there was William Grant, watching them, concerned, clearly mad for her brother.
"Franny," Vincent said, "do not argue with me. Let me be who I am."
As she threw her arms around him, she forgot about the salt and the rosemary and the curse and the ways fate could surprise you.
"Then I wish you happiness," she said,
for that was really all she'd ever wanted for him. There was a crow on the lamppost on New Year's Day. They'd had a small dinner, stuffing a goose with Aunt Isabel's recipe, which included chestnuts and oysters, sure to inflame the erotic center of anyone who partook of the meal. Vincent and William took off after helping to wash up, laughing as they packed some of Vincent's belongings. He was so often at William's apartment, it seemed he lived there. After he'd gone, Franny saw that he'd left the Magus at home, which she took to be a good sign. She went after it, thinking she would hide it under a loose floorboard in the kitchen, and perhaps Vincent would forget about it entirely. But when she went to grab the text, it burned her fingers.
"Fine," she said to the book, "as long as you leave him be."
As Franny and Jet stored away the dishes, Jet noticed the crow in the yard.
"Isn't that Lewis?"
Franny went to greet him, having not seen him in more than 2 years. When she held up her arms, he came to light on her shoulder. No matter what anyone said about crows, there were indeed tears in his eyes.
"Is it Halen?" Franny asked.
The crow rested his beak against her cheek, and she knew that it was. She went inside and found the phone number of Dunster House. The crow paced on the coffee table and kept an eye on her. Jet paced as well, as Franny did her best to get through to the school. It was a holiday, and Harvard was all but deserted. At last, a custodian answered. As Franny wasn't a relative, he couldn't give out any information. "Don't take no for an answer," Jet urged. "Stand up for yourself." Franny pleaded with the custodian, who at last gave in, telling her that the student in question had been taken to Mass General Hospital.
"Of course you'll go," Jet said. "There's no question about it." "But what if I ruin him?" Franny asked her sister. "Maybe I should stay."
Franny had never before asked for her sister's advice, and Jet was somewhat startled, especially because she had not been forthcoming about her own life. She had intended not to see Raphael again, but that's not how things turned out. They often met outside the hotel, then walked through the park. Jet read the papers he wrote for class, And later, when he wrote a book about teaching kids who had been labeled unteachable, he thanked her in his dedication, although no one in his family had ever met her.